Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Martel, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benhart. Chapter 26, The Obvious Thing. The stars were paling overhead, and the snow that cut against the sky was growing white again. But it was very cold among the pines, where Ledger was busy about the crackling fire. A column of smoke rose slowly straight up into the nipping air, and the blaze flickered redly upon the clustering trunks, while the sound of an unfrozen rapid broke faintly through the snapping of the fire. Ledger, who felt his finger stiffening, took up his axe, and the rhythmic thudding rang sharply in the stillness of the woods, when Hetty appeared in the door of the shanty, shadowy and shapeless in the coarse blanket she had thrown about her shoulders. She shivered a little as she looked around her. "It has been a bitter night. The cold woke me when the fire got low," she said. "Tomlinson must have felt it horribly. I wonder where he's getting his breakfast. You shouldn't have let him go." Ledger laughed and leaned upon his axe. "I couldn't have stopped him, and I don't think you need worry. The cold is scarcely likely to hurt him. He's used to it. He is probably 3 or 4 leagues away down the trail by now."
"That isn't very far."
"It's tolerably good traveling in this country. Besides, nobody except Sewell and Ingleby has the faintest notion that he was here." Hetty appeared reflective.
"I wasn't quite sure about the corporal that night. He's too quiet and has eyes all over him. Still, I suppose Tomlinson has got away. Of course, he must have done so. His running away would look very bad if they did get hold of him. Isn't that kettle boiling, Tom?"
Ledger stooped above the fire and then, straightening himself, suddenly stood still, listening. He could hear the sound of the rapid and nothing else for a moment or two, until a crackle of undergrowth came out of the gloom below. Then there was a tramp of footsteps coming up the trail, and Hetty turned to him sharply.
"Tom," she said with a little gasp, "who can it be?"
Ledger laid down the kettle he held in his hand.
"The troopers, I'm afraid," he said.
The light was growing clearer, and they could see each other's faces. Hetty's was flushed and apprehensive, Ledger's portentously quiet.
"They've come for Tomlinson," she said. "Tom, do you know why he threw Probyn in the creek?"
"I fancy I could guess. Tomlinson, however, never mentioned it."
"He wouldn't." And Hetty gasped again. "Tom, I'll never forgive you if you let the troopers know anything about him."
"I really don't think that was necessary," said Ledger with a faint, dry smile.
Hetty clutched one hand tight.
"Oh," she said, "can't we run away?"
Ledger turned and pointed to a shadowy figure that materialized out of the gloom among the trees below. There were others behind it, and the two stood still watching them as they came quickly up the trail. Then they stopped at a sharp word, and a man in a big fur coat stepped forward. Hetty had no difficulty in recognizing him as Esmond.
"Are you willing to tell me where Prospector Tomlinson is? It would be the wisest thing," he said.
"I don't think that is quite the point," answered Ledger quietly. "You see, I don't know."
"Then I'll ask you where he went when he left here last night."
"You fancy he was here?" Esmond made a little sign of impatience.
I should like to warn you that a good deal depends upon the way you answer me. You probably know that the person who hides a murderer, or connives at his escape, is liable to be tried as an accessory.
Ledger stood silent a moment or two. It seemed rather more than probable that Esmond had only supposed it likely that Tomlinson had visited the bakery. But that did not greatly matter after all. His course was clear, and that was to allow the officer to believe, as long as possible, that Tomlinson was in the vicinity. Every minute gained would be worth a good deal to the fugitive.
"I scarcely think I need worry myself about that," he said. "You see, before you could charge me as an accessory, you would have to prove that Tomlinson really killed Proben. It's tolerably clear that you can't have a trial without a prisoner, and I don't mind admitting that Tomlinson isn't here."
Esmond smiled unpleasantly and signed to one of the troopers who went into the shanty.
"He certainly isn't very far away. I have no doubt you could tell me where he would make for, but you do not seem to know that he was shot, and we have reason to believe badly wounded within a league of your house last night."
It was growing light now, and he saw the sudden horror in Hetty's eyes.
"If you have any control over your brother, Miss Ledger, I think it would be wise for you to use it," he said.
"You would not like him to get himself into trouble?" Hetty straightened herself a little.
"If he knew where Tomlinson was and told you, I'd be ashamed of him forever. But he doesn't," she said.
Esmond glanced at her sharply. She stood very straight, regarding him with a set white face, and it was evident that she was resolute. Then he turned to Ledger.
"Are you willing to expose your sister to a very serious charge?" he asked.
Again Ledger stood silent, but when he glanced at her, a little flash showed in Hetty's eyes.
"You daren't disgrace us both. Remember, it was all my fault," she said.
Then Ledger turned to the officer.
"I do not know where Tomlinson is. That is all I have to tell you."
Esmond raised his hand.
"Then I arrest you both for concealing Prospector Tomlinson and contriving his escape. You will hand them over to Robertson at the outpost, Trooper Greve, and then come on after us as fast as you can. I don't wish to submit either of you to any indignity, Ledger, unless you are likely to make it necessary."
Ledger's face turned crimson, but he made a little sign of comprehension.
"We will make no attempt to get away."
Esmond signed to the trooper, who pointed somewhat shamefacedly to the shadowy path among the pines as he swung his carbine to the trail. Then Hetty and Ledger moved on in front of him, while Esmond and the others vanished into the bush. It was almost daylight now, and the troopers spent some time tracing Tomlinson's footsteps between the trunks. They also found the thicket where he had flung himself down, but that, after all, told them very little, and both the by-trail and the larger one were tramped too hard for his worn-out boots to leave any recognizable impression. It was, however, evident that Tomlinson could have adopted only one of two courses. If he had escaped uninjured, he would certainly head for the settlements along the beaten trail, down which a trooper had been sent already. But no wounded man could face that arduous journey, and assuming that the corporal's shot had taken effect, he would, as a matter of course, be lurking somewhere in the valley. In that case, the trailing of him could only be a question of a day or two, for even if he could face the bitter frost in the open, he must have food, and there would be no difficulty in tracing the footsteps of anyone who brought it to him. The one question was whether Tomlinson was badly hurt, and as the corporal who fancied so could not be quite sure, Esmond pushed on southwards along the trail.
If Tomlinson had not headed in that direction, he was in the valley, and if so, he certainly could not get away. As a matter of fact, he was just then lying weak from loss of blood in a little decrepit shanty on an abandoned claim. He had contrived to reach one of the miners' dwellings late the previous night, though he was never quite sure how he accomplished it, and fell in across the threshold when its astonished owner opened the door. The man, however, kept his head, and within an hour, Tomlinson was carried to the claim in one of the more distant gorges, where it appeared a little less likely that Esmond would lay hands on him. Now he was huddled, half sensible, in his blanket upon a pile of cedar twigs, with Ingleby and a young American who had just dug out a carbine bullet, which had badly smashed his shoulder blade, sitting by his side. Ingleby did not know whether his companion was a qualified surgeon, but he had at least contrived to cut out the bullet and staunch the wound. He appeared a trifle anxious about his patient. "The shock would have dropped a man raised in the cities right off, but I think we'll pull him round," he said. "Still, it's not going to be done in a day or two." The fact was very evident, and Ingleby nodded. "How long do you think it will be before he can walk again?" he said. "A month, anyway, and quite likely 6 weeks. That is, before you could let him start out on the trail. I don't quite know what we're going to do with him in the meanwhile." Tomlinson, who appeared to understand him, looked up with his face awry. "Not going to do anything," he said half-coherently. "I'll give myself up. I can't stay here and make trouble for the boys." "You go to sleep," said the other man severely, and made a little sign to Ingleby, who sat silent for a minute or two, after Tomlinson sank back again on the twigs. "That's just the point," he said. "The boys don't mean to let the police have him." "No," and Ingleby's manner suggested that the subject was not worth discussion. "They wouldn't think of it for a minute. I'd have nothing more to do with them if they did." The American nodded. "Well," he said, "I can pull the man round, but I'm not going to answer for what will happen if the troopers get hold of him. He's tough, but he wants looking after, and there's no one at the outpost knows more than enough to pull a stone out of a cayuse hoof." "You can take out a bullet anyway," said Ingleby suggestively. "Oh yes, I'd have had quite a nice practice by this time, if it had been convenient for me to stay in Connecticut. As it happened, it wasn't." Ingleby looked at him steadily. "Tomlinson," he said, "is a friend of mine, and that, of course, implies an obligation. You, so far as I know, have had very little to do with him, and it seems only reasonable to warn you that you may get yourself into serious trouble by looking after him. The law is generally carried out in our country." The American laughed. "I can take my chances. I'm not going back on a sick man anyway." He said nothing more for a while, until a man who had apparently been running came in.
"Where's Cyril?" he gasped.
"I don't know," said Ingleby. "He wasn't at home this morning. Most likely he's looking for a deer."
"Then I guess you'll have to do. Esmond has trailed Tomlinson to the bakery. He's got Hetty and Tom Ledger at the outpost now."
Ingleby rose suddenly to his feet.
"You're quite sure?" "Well," said the other, "I guess I ought to be. I met them. Trooper Grieve didn't stop their talking, and they told me. Esmond tried to bluff where Tomlinson was out of them, and they're going to stand in with him as accessories."
It was evident to Ingleby that since Sewell was away, a heavy responsibility devolved upon him as a friend of Tomlinson and Ledger. He was expected to do something, and as usual, he did the obvious thing, without counting what it would cost him.
"Where's Esmond?" he asked. "Hitting the trail to the settlements for all he's worth," said the other man.
"Then go round and let the boys know what you have told me. They can meet outside Ransom's shanty. The dinner hour will do. I'll be there to meet them." The man went out, and at the time appointed, Ingleby stood outside a little hut of bark and logs, with a crowd of bronze-faced men about him. They were somewhat silent, but their manner was quietly resolute. It suggested that their minds were made up, and they were only waiting for a leader in whom they had confidence. Ingleby had gained their liking, but he was young, and they were not quite sure whether he would be the man or whether they must choose another. In the meanwhile, they were willing to give him a hearing. It was evident that he was equal to the occasion when he stepped forward and looked at them with steady eyes. "Boys," he said, "do any of you believe Tomlinson killed Trooper Probyn?" There was a general murmur of dissent, and Ingleby made a little sign of concurrence. "Are you willing to let the troopers have him? You must remember that the thing looks bad against him, and he will not be tried by you." The murmurs were articulate now, and it was very clear that not a man there had the least intention of giving up Tomlinson. "Then it should be quite plain that you will have to keep the troopers from him. It is only a question of a day or two at the longest before they trail him. They may do it tonight. Esmond will very soon find out that he isn't pushing on in front of him for the settlements." A big man stood forward and glanced at the rest. "There's not a trooper in this valley going to lay hands on Tomlinson." Again the murmurs rose portentously, and Ingleby smiled. "Well," he said, "since the trouble can't be shuffled off, we may as well face it now. We have got to make a stand and maintain it until Esmond finds he has to humor us. He has Ledger and his sister in the outpost. Do you know any reason why we shouldn't take them out?" "I guess not," said the man who had spoken already. "Still, if there's any shooting, two or three of us are going to smell trouble, as well as Tomlinson." "There will not be any," said Ingleby. "Esmond has only two men at the outpost. Nobody wants to hurt them. The thing can be done without it. In fact, that's essential. I want three or four determined men." They were forthcoming, but one of the rest asked a question. "Have you figured out what's going to happen when Esmond comes back?" he said. "I have," said Ingleby. "He will have a handful of tolerably active men under his orders then, but only a handful after all. Now the outpost's outside the canyon, and there's a spot where a log barricade would effectively block the trail. The troopers will have to be kept outside it until we can arrive at a compromise. Esmond will probably make it. It would be 2 months anyway before he could get more troopers in, and if there's another heavy snowfall, it mightn't be done till spring." None of those who listened could find fault with the scheme. It was evidently workable, and they had already decided that Tomlinson was not to be given up at any cost. That, as Ingleby had pointed out, would necessarily involve them in difficulties with the police. There was thus very little further discussion, and the men went back, a trifle thoughtfully, to their work until the evening. It seemed to most of them a long while coming, but to none of them slower than it did to Hetty Ledger, who sat with her brother in a very little log-walled room at the outpost as dusk was closing down. Tom Ledger, glancing at her as she sat huddled in a chair by the window, fancied that she was crying. "Why did we come here, Tom?" she said. "Everything has gone wrong since we left Vancouver." "The outlook certainly isn't very cheerful just now," said Ledger with a rueful smile. "Still, after all, you made a good many dollars at the bakery, and my claim is doing well. Ingleby will see that while I'm kept here, the work is carried on. One can put up with a good deal of inconvenience when he's washing out gold dust." "Dollars," said Hetty, "and gold dust. Is there nothing else worth having?" "Well," said Ledger dryly, "when you have no prospect of getting it, It's as well to content oneself with dollars. If I remember rightly, you used to think a good deal of a shilling in England.
Hetty glanced at him sharply with hazy eyes.
What do you mean by no prospect of getting it?
I don't quite know. You suggested the notion anyway. I scarcely think Esmond can make out very much of a case against us. He doesn't really know that Tomlinson was at the bakery.
And isn't that that's worrying me? It's everything, said Hetty.
I don't think you need cry over Tomlinson. The boys will take care of him.
I wasn't crying about Tomlinson. In fact, I'm not sure I was crying at all. Still, you see, it was all my fault.
Ledger smiled whimsically. Well, he said, I scarcely think that should afford you any great satisfaction, though it almost seems to do so. No doubt it's part of a girl's nature to make trouble of the kind.
Hetty closed one hand.
I'm going to be angry in a minute. That's not the way to talk to anyone who's feeling what I am just now.
Ledger rose and patted her shoulder.
I'd sooner see you raging than looking as you do. Shake the mood off, Hetty. It isn't in the least like you.
Hetty said nothing, but turned from him and looked out of the little window. A young trooper was leaning over the rude balustrade of the veranda, and beyond him the somber pines rolled down the darkening valley. Night had not quite fallen yet, though a half-moon that showed red and frosty was growing brighter above the white shoulder of the hill. Another trooper was apparently busy in the adjoining room, for they could hear his footsteps as he moved, but that was the only sound. Then a face rose suddenly into sight above the floor of the veranda where the trooper could not see it. It was a horrible gray face, and Hetty shrank back while her chair grated harshly on the floor. In another moment, Tom Ledger's hand closed tightly on her arm. Keep still, he said. It's a moused man. I fancy the boys have come for us. Hetty looked again and saw that a strip of deer hide with holes cut in it was tied across the face. Then she became sensible that there was something suggestively familiar in the attitude of the man, who, moving noiselessly, raised himself erect and stood watching the trooper, whose back was towards him.
Oh, she gasped. It's Walter.
Be quiet, said Ledger.
And the grasp upon her arm grew tighter. Another face appeared between the rails, but the first man had already swung one leg over them, and in another moment he sprang forward along the veranda. The trooper heard him and swung round, but even as he did so, the newcomer flung his arms about him, and they reeled together down the little stairway. Then the second trooper flung open the door, but as he ran out of it, two or three men who had apparently crept into the veranda grappled with him, and Hetty could hear them tumbling up and down the adjoining room. Then there was a brief silence, until somebody burst open the door of the room in which she was shut. A moused man who strode in grasped her shoulder, and she struggled vainly as he drew her towards the door.
"I won't go. It will only get you into worse trouble," she said.
The man laughed. If I had to face it all my life, do you think I would leave you here?
Hetty recognized the tension in his voice, and something seemed to answer it, thrilled in her. But still she protested, and the man who flung an arm about her waist swung her off her feet. He did not let her go until he set her down, flushed and gasping, among the pines outside. Then she laughed.
I'm not sure you could have done that in England, Walter.
No, said Ingleby. Anyway, you wouldn't have let me. But we can't stop to talk now. Esmond may come back at any time, and there is a good deal to do. He turned from her suddenly. You have got those fellows' carbines? Oh, yes, said another man. We'd better bring along their cartridges and heave them into the river, too. We haven't heard either of them much, considering.
Ingleby signed to the rest, though he still held Hetty's arm.
Now, he said, the sooner we light out of this, the better it will be for everybody.
Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more exciting Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows.
by Harold Binlaws.